Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. Last week we had a really moving, amazing show. Got over 100,000 listeners. This week we're going to continue on the same theme, but from a little bit of different side. We will have with us Sarah Benjamin, a mother whose child was a little bit different. He was artsy, he loved music, etc., and he died of an overdose. He muted the pain with drugs. We'll listen to this mother tell her story. We will also be speaking to Rabbi Yaakov Berman, who runs Operation Survival, and he will discuss talking to our children. And you know what? That's very controversial. Do we or don't we talk to our children about these things? Are we making them aware of things they shouldn't be aware of? We will also be speaking to Rabbi Joseph Oritz, one of the premier educators. He's the principal of Berea High School. And we'll be speaking to him about his protocol for removing a child from school, kicking a kid out in plain English, right? So these should be three fascinating discussions. But I want to say something really important. This is Shabbos Nachmo, Matzah Shabbos Nachmo. And what did we just learn? We said, Eli Tzion V'Areh, weep, be misabel for Tzion cities, K'may Isha B'Tzireh, like a woman giving birth, birthing pains. And the question is, that's a really strange analogy. Like a woman giving birth, it should say like a woman dying or somebody dying. But you see something magical about Yiddishkeit, that even the most terrible of events, like the Churban Habayis, how did Chazal consider it? Birthing pains. Something newer, greater is going to come from it. What tzaras we have, it's a birthing pain. It's going to give birth to something, a new neshama, a new life, something greater. We have to find the new chiyus, the positive, in something terrible. So here's to something. You know, there was complaints, the principals, so many of the commons, the principals, the schools, they're desperate to maintain a certain standard. And if your child doesn't fit in a box, there's a checked box. And you know the stories, what the boxes are? You have to behave a certain way. You have to come from a certain family. Forget it. I mean, Bali Tshuva, Gerim, forget about it. In certain communities, the father's working or the father's, you know, learning. Everyone, box, box, box. A child doesn't fit into their box. They're an artsy type. They're not the clear-headed. You know, do you think Picasso would have gotten into any one of these schools? You have to fit certain boxes. And if you don't fit into that box, you're out. You're discarded. That seemed to be, you know, a theme. You're not smart enough. You know. So let me share, what's the light that we could discover from this? It's Matzah Shabbos. You know, historically, it's been a time to tell stories. So let me tell you a story. In the city of Yerushalayim, 100 years ago, Yerushalayim Shalmaila, maybe 150 years ago, the great yeshiva was Eitz Chaim, was founded by Reb Shmuel Salant and by the Brisker of Shulayb Diskin. It was a great yeshiva. It put out the leaders of Klal Yisrael, the Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Rav of Yerushalayim, the Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap, Gedolim Gedol. When Reb Shmuel Salant was about to pass away, he put his einigel, who married his granddaughter, Reb Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky, to become the new head of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. And he was a brilliant person. He was a mathematician. He's a genius. He wrote the Seder Hazmanim on the calendar still used today. If you want to know when to break the fast on Tisha B'Av, my wife says, could we use Rav Tkachinsky's man? He was just a brilliant person. He was all excited. He took over as Rosh Yeshiva. And boy, was he disappointed. He said, I was expecting the great Litvish alumdom. You know, he was a Litvak. He was born in Lechovich, in Litva. And what do I come here? It's like all this disparate, untalented kids. I can't find who to talk to, like, about Reb Chaim. He was lost. He decided he was going to resign. Before he resigned, he went to the Reb Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, the head of the Achreides. He was, de facto the Rav of Yerushalayim, and he went to him. And he said, I really want out. What should I do? I'm frustrated. Reb Yosef Chaim tried to talk to him. Reb Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld said, you know, there's one person here in Yerushalayim who, when I have something, I go to him. I really respect him. Who was that? That was the Saba Kadisha, the holy Saba. He had come from Turkey. He had been the chief Rav in Damascus, then in Tzfas. He was over 100 years old. And he was a fiery person. He wouldn't talk to anybody who didn't have a beard. They say Rav Hutna, weren't in Slobodka. in Hebron, and he wanted to go see him. He wouldn't see anybody without a beard. He became the first Bachur in Hebron to grow a beard. He wanted to say, he wanted to meet the Saba Kadisha and speak to him. Do you know, the Munkacha, the Menchas Elazar, traveled from Hungary. It was 4 months each way to be able to speak to the Saba Kadisha, the greatest Kabbalist of his era. In fact, Yosef Chaim Lenefeld used to go with him with issues to ask his advice, but he had a strict policy. He only saw people 1 hour a day, and if you didn't make it in that hour, so he came to him on Sukkot. He had an hour a day. Exactly at an hour, he locked his Sukkot door, and he started learning basmud inside the Sukkot. Yosef Chaim came, it was an hour and 4 minutes, banging, banging, banging. He didn't open the door. So a few weeks later, he saw him. He was all upset. He said, you know, Damascus Rav, I came all the way, and you wouldn't open the door for me. I knocked, and Yosef Chaim was like upset, you know. So the Saba Kadisha looked at him, and he said, why are you upset? He said, you know how often I knock on the doors of heaven. I bang, and they don't answer me. Why would you be upset if I don't answer your knocking? So this was fiery, that 100. So he decided, okay, he's going to the Saba Kadisha. So Rabbi Chil Michel goes to the Saba Kadisha. And he tells him, I'm tearing my head out. I don't see, I can't find, I'm looking for the lumdim, who's going to lead the generation, etc. And I just want to go back to my farm. I'm giving it up. I'm done. I can't find the boys who check my boxes. And Fandri looked at him and he said, there's no gedolim? What? He spoke Hebrew because he didn't speak Yiddish. He was Sephardi. Ataloma gedolim? You don't see any gedolim in the yeshiva? He looked at him and he says, Ani makir kama gedolim. I know a number of boys who are going to be great leaders, in many different colors, in many different lights. I know. So he was all surprised. You know them. And I look around. I just see this mass of mediocrity. He said, Mihaim. But the interview was over. Saba Kadisha picked up his tea, waved his hand to his guy. Time is up. My hour is done. No more people. And he picked them up, and they hustled them out. He goes home and he tells his wife, his Rebbetzin, I don't know what to do. He told me this coming up. He didn't tell me the names. My time was up beforehand. So she said, I guess you're going to have to figure it out on your own. She went back to Yeshiva and he started looking at the Bachurim. And, you know, this, and he saw one Bachur he thought was like, you know, it was just a buck. He wasn't like a lamb in the old Litvisha ways. He said, but he has a great memory. Maybe he means him, and he started putting energy into that one. Well, this one seems to like more Mashava, Drush, and he started in each Bacha trying, because he knew they were there. And you know who came out of that group? The Tzitz Eliezer. He was the biggest Baki in the world. He wrote 20 volumes on Halacha of medicine, of Eretz Yisrael. He would quote, if you look at it, Svarim nobody ever heard of. He read a Sefer, he never forgot it. He became one of the biggest of that entire generation. Who else? Rav Ashlag, the great Mekubal, he wrote the Sulam. Also 15 volumes, 20 volumes on the Zohar. All today it became the new classic. Anybody who learns Zohar learns that. Rabbi Yashiv learned there for a little while. And of course, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was a Litvish Rosh Hashiva, but with Psak, with very different, not a lot of Litvish Rosh Hashivas combined Halacha and Psak. You know who ultimately learned here? The Ger Rebbe, the Amshinov Rebbe, who could daven for 8 hours a day. He told him to give Kama Gvan, not necessarily the Gedolim you were looking for. Now, I told over this story to somebody. I had heard the story to Sanyu Shwaim, and the guy said, well, did he really know these people? Just being very wise old Makubal, he said, look a little bit harder. I said, I don't know. I imagine the second. It didn't seem that there were a lot of Bachur from Eitz Chaim who used to go to the Saba Kadisha. So what does that mean? If you're not finding them, you maybe have to, like, to quote somebody, he said, it's not that more people are off the derech, it's just maybe the derech has just gotten too narrow. So there are different gifts. What did the Saba Kadisha tell us? There are different children who have different gifts. You know, the Gemara in Bracha says, Haroya Uchusei Yisrael, somebody sees a mass of Jews, 600,000, what does he say? Blessed is he, Baruch HaCham HaRazim, the knower of secrets. Because Kishem Shem Parsufeim Shavis Kachte Yisem Shavis, the knower of secrets. And the Mepharshim say the knower of secrets. It's just the wise God who created different people. He said, no. To be able to understand each one, you have to be Chacham HaRazim. You have to know the secrets, because each person has their secret. It's not one box to check. There are many checks, and the principal who who maybe inherited the school, maybe we have to become Yedei HaRazim. It's Chacham HaRazim. It's a tremendous effort to be a principal. What an incredible wise we would have to be. Different gifts. You know, on my block, I grew up in Borough Park. I lived there for many years. There was a woman. She had 5 daughters, and she was elderly. And every day, one of her daughters would come. The same daughter would come and take her up the block for walks. And this, I once met her. She was walking the daughter. She was like in her early 80s, I would guess. And she looked, she put her hand on her daughter. She said, you know, this child growing up was my worst student. But she was different. She had the biggest heart. She said, I have a daughter who's a doctor, who's a lawyer, who's a rabbi. This one had a heart as big as the ocean. I have more nachas in front of the daughter, she said, than all my other children. So we have different gifts and different hearts. The child, and you know, there was a Sephardi girl, let me tell you today. Her name is Beryl Ben Saraf. You could Google her. Her father won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Brilliant. Beryl was born dyslexic. What a disappointment to a family of, you know, a few Nobel Prize winners there ought to be. He pushed her through school. He wanted her to go to medical school. He was a Nobel Prize laureate. He called up Harvard, and they accepted her. And she says, it was the 4 worst years of my life. She's dyslexic. She struggled. She couldn't read the books, but she could memorize what the teacher said. And something amazing happened in the 4th year. They started learning radiology, and it's about reading x-rays and stuff. And she said they brought in an ultrasound, and the teacher's explaining, you know, the child's in this position. And he said, I looked at the picture, and I said, but isn't the child's leg a little? And she said to me, the other students didn't know what they were looking at, and the picture started singing to me. And then they brought in x-rays, and her teacher said, the Harvard teacher of radiology, in 30 years, I never met somebody who could read an image like her. And she said, there was something in my brain, it's wired different. I see pictures, they're like music. They just talk to me and talk to me. So what did she do? She was the one who discovered all kinds of new fetal syndrome. There's a tiny extra fold of chin under a child who has autistic. They were able to discover. She's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Radiology, which is the worldwide journal of radiology. She had a different gift, a different talent. And you see this all the time. You know, where I live in Wesley Hills in Muncie, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, a guy came in, laser shiner, loose shiner. And what did he do? He built the shul, and he started bringing incredible speakers, Rabbanim. He created what is today the hottest shul in the entire Rockland County. I mean, Tisha B'Av, they had a video feed. He said there were 15,000 people watching it. And he said to me, you know, David, I was thrown out of 6th grade because I couldn't sit. I wasn't a student. He had different energies. Oh, boy, could this guy accomplish? And he talks to a person 2 minutes. He has EQ. IQ, his IQ in understanding people is like off the charts genius, right? He said, I couldn't show me a triangle. I had no interest in triangles. A triangle never spoke to me. He was thrown out of yeshiva. He said, and he never went back to English. He was a dropout in 6th grade. He said, they came to me 10 years ago. The yeshiva always dropped out. They wanted me to build their building. And he said, and I had no connection to them. They had thrown me out. He said, I just gave them $100. I showed them on their way. He's built many buildings besides that. He does 250,000 meals a year in Uman. I mean, or Nachman, whatever it is, but just the incredible power of one person thrown out of 6th grade because he didn't check their box. He looked at me, he said, they threw out the wrong person, right? Different gifts, right? What is the challenge? Find those different gifts. You know, that's as far as the principals, but it's not the principal's fault. I think we are also involved. I saw there was a letter from this judge. She wrote that the parents, when this girl, Malki, 4 parents came to this principal who had accepted her, and they said, if she's in, we're out. I don't want my child in together with a kid who isn't have such high academic standards, who maybe isn't so bright. How are they going to study together? What's this going to do for your school's reputation? We're out. So the principals, their hearings are often bound too. And you know what? I think as parents, what we have to say is, you know, maybe the child couldn't study with your child, But you know what? Listen to this. Maybe they could have learned something really great from Malky. You know what that is? Malky struggled. And there are different children. The artsy kids struggle like anything. The Picassos, the music, the kids who love music. They're different mindsets. You know, there are Maya Briggs, there are 16 personality types. Maybe they could have learned something else from struggling Malky. Maybe they could have learned how to tutor a child who's struggling. Like the brothers and sisters who have a child who, well, has Down syndrome or autism. What do they do? They say these children educate the family. They educate the rest of the siblings on how not to be selfish and how to give and how to tutor and how to be a big brother and a big sister. Maybe Malky could have taught these kids something more. You know what she could have taught them? Greater than what the school teaches? She could have taught them what it means to be a Yid, what it means to be human, what it means to be Jewish, what it means to be a real Bas Yisrael or a Ben Yisrael. You know, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, my Rebbe in Mir, he used to say there's a Gemara in Erevin and Nun and Aleph and Beis in that zip code. The Gemara says that there was a great scholar of Preda, brilliant scholar. He was the third Doer of Amorayim. Because of him, his whole generation, the Gemara says, went to Ilum Hava. That he had a child who was, he taught him 400 times Gemara. You talk about stupid, this kid, next to the word stupid in the dictionary, they must have had a cute picture of this kid, right? Challenged. And one day it said the child was distracted and he had to teach it to him another 400 times. So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said, you know, that's great, but it must be that Peder, one of the great Talmidei Chachamim's generation, was Makbed on Bittul Torah. What did he learn those 400 times? What was his limud? Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said, you know what he learned? He learned how to be a Jew, how to be a Yid. All our Gedolim, what does it say about Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu had said when he saw the suffering of the Jews, he stood there and he cried until he was sick. He said, how do I take their klep? Maybe they can smite me instead of their Jews getting smitten. How can I absorb some of their pain? This is the first time we see Moshe Rabbeinu. First time, he put his life at risk to help. That is the lesson. Maybe Malky could have taught us all, me and you, how to be Jewish or our children. What a great lesson that we missed that lesson. We have a fantastic program this week. Let's go to our guests. We have on the phone with us from Brooklyn, New York, Mrs. Sarah Benjamin, who wants to tell us a story about her child that I think is poignant and powerful and worth listening to. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about your son?
My son's name was Kasriel. He was 25 years old when he passed away. He died of apparent heroin overdose, if that's what the police said it looked like. He was not living at home at that time. We were living in Flatbush, and he was in an apartment in Crown Heights, and his roommate found him. It was a total shock. We had no idea he was using hard drugs or, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if on weekends, you know, he went to a party or something, but we had no idea he was abusing drugs at all. And this was about, it'll be 6 years in Elo. He didn't seem to be, I mean, we didn't notice any signs of trouble, honestly. He had a lot of friends, active social life. He was between jobs at that time. He was very, very warm, very popular, easygoing guy. Obviously, there were things going on that, you know, a lot of people didn't know about.
What would you think? I mean, precipitated. Why? You know, usually children don't start using drugs. What would you say was, like, what caused it?
I puzzled over this a lot, obviously. I've had almost 6 years to think about it. And I've been giving a lot of thought to the topic in general. We didn't know that he was abusing drugs. He had eating disorder. I mean, he had been a compulsive overeater and had lost a lot of weight in the last couple of years, which now I'm assuming was drug-related, but he looked great. I mean, in fact, you know, he looked the best he ever did because he'd been quite overweight before. I don't know with him what precipitated it. I think that any kind of addictive behavior is a lot more complicated than I had thought. We had 10 children. He was one of the middle children. And a lot of my children had struggled with various they were very creative, not all of them, but most of them very creative, lively, had trouble focusing in school, sitting still. He wasn't really so much, but I guess, you know, I look back at his report cards when I cleaned through his things, and he really wasn't doing so well, but he was in the middle of a big family, seemed to be doing okay. I don't think it's looking backwards that anybody that's abusing drugs is medicating pain. And to look back at, you know, what might cause pain, I don't know in his case, and I can't ask him, and I didn't ask him. We were very close, but he didn't really want to make me worry. So I really don't know. He had been having some trouble with anxiety, which he'd shared with me a few months before. But I can't give you that answer specifically, but I have thoughts in general. I mean, about generally what, in terms of, say, like looking at my children and my extended family, and I think, let me preface, I have a few thoughts in general, you know, that I've been thinking about since, you know, he passed away. And the first thing, just to save my sanity, I had to stop and say, wait a minute, nobody could have prevented this. And there's no such thing as drug prevention. I mean, not drug prevention, overdose prevention, or, you know, saving someone from dying, per se. That I have to believe he was given 25 years to live, you know, from the beginning of time, that's how long he was meant to be on the earth, and that there were no mistakes, that he lived the life he was meant to live. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't people in pain, you know, and in various types of pain from not fitting in, from struggling in school, from failing in school, from being super sensitive to social cues and not quite getting it, and you know, various different things that I've seen in, you know, other people and in my children.
Describe not fitting in. What does that mean?
You know, like a child who's not able to sit in class, and keeps getting sent out, and they're being told, or I have a few kids that were told that they're not learning up to their potential. But that doesn't, like, so they're, like, kept telling them over and over again, but that doesn't help anything. It just tells the kid, like, the kid's doing the best they can, and they're still not making it. I have children who repeatedly were getting sent home, kicked out, weren't accepted to high school. I related so much to Mr. Klein's interview. Most of my children learn all right, but they have attention problems, some of them, and, you know, really couldn't sit still. If you would give them an art project, they'd be in heaven and they could sit for 3 days straight, but that's not what yeshivas do. And being told to apply yourself and sit still, and you don't have those abilities to do that, especially when the subject matter is boring to you, causes a lot of pain, and, you know.
And do you find that it's usually the more creative? Is it possible, and I heard this from, you know, people who deal with Nebuchadnezzar's cases, that it's usually the more creative, more sensitive, the more loved children who feel this shame more, or feel this not fitting in more, and feel this, do you find that?
I think it's complicated. I've been doing a lot of reading this year. I think that there are people who are extremely sensitive, and some of them, because of their sensitivity, will gravitate towards, you know, art and music and those kind of things rather than, you know, math and reading and that, those kind of things. But the sensitivity is underlying all of it, meaning sensitivity towards, you know, they don't roll with the punches as well. Sometimes they're not as sensitive enough socially. Sometimes they're just not getting it socially, and their friends, you know, they're being told shut up or, you know, stop talking or hold still. It's not a one shot kind of thing. I think it's a complicated issue.
So talk to me about Kasriel. What was he like?
As a child, he was very close to me. He was all quite artistic, sensitive. He was interested in photography. He also tried very, very hard to go with the program. I don't think he even was doing drugs until his early 20s, which is unusual. I don't think he was involved in anything like that when he was in his young teens. He was doing the right thing. He liked to please us, and he liked to be peaceful, and he had a lot of friends, and everybody, you know, he was one of these guys that everybody would talk, people would talk to him. He was a very good listener, which, you know, looking back, maybe he should have done some talking himself, but you know, people would come to him and talk to him a lot.
What was yeshiva like for him? How did he like school?
I don't think he liked it so much. I mean, looking back at his report card, mostly he was like, you know, goofing off and stuff like that. He tried. I mean, he did go to yeshiva. He was in a smicha program for a while. The school closed when he was partway through. I don't think it was terrible for him. I don't think it was great either. He was one of these guys that didn't want to make ripples, and he went along with it. He was smart. He could learn.
Why was he in so much pain?
I think that I can't say for sure, but I think that looking back, life in general was hard for him. I think he was very, very sensitive to people and to environment, and probably there was a level of stress there due to sensitivity, which, you know, a more average person isn't dealing with that level of stress, that just the general environment of being alive. And I think he had a hard time transitioning into adulthood, dating, all these things. I think everything, if he found things hard, just, again, I it's very hard because he didn't talk to me about it, really. He was always cheerful, and honestly, there's so much that goes on in your child's life that you just don't know about. You think you know them, and it's just astounding how much I didn't, for the good and for the bad. I mean, I don't know what went on negatively with him, but after he died, so many people came to the shiva, like several hundred people came to the Levaya, you know, all these friends that I didn't know he had. And like a young couple drove up from California, and they named their first child after him that I'd never heard of, like that they were friends with him. So, like, you know, I didn't know, there's so many ways I didn't know him.
Do you think the yeshiva failed him in any way?
I don't look at it like that. I don't think that, you know, that the yeshivas in general have much to offer a kid that's more creative or not so interested in learning Gemara or Mishnayos. They don't really, that's not the setup. It's not what it's geared for. They don't have time for it, and I think it's a pity, really, for all my children that part of them could not have been developed, and that would have been an area. My kids were also very athletic, and there wasn't much for them to do with that. I think that from my experience, you know, I have mostly boys. I have two girls and eight boys. From my experience, especially with both boys and girls. I think that my boys suffered more because they were very athletic and active and whatever. The concept of sitting in a row and learning Gemara all day and learning things by rote, not much stimulus. And I think it's a typical, I think, yeshiva. That was not a place that some of the kids thrived in that environment. Not very many, but some did. Most of mine didn't. And I think they just blame themselves. They feel like, what's wrong with me that I can't do this? This is what's expected. This is my whole life. Everybody's telling me I can do this.
But shouldn't we mostly all fit into that box of being able to learn for X number of hours a day?
No. I don't know. They can't. They can't. I think that the most important things that I wish for my children, I wish my children had gotten out of yeshiva, learn how to be a mensch, learn how to love your religion, understand, you know, the basic things behind it. Some children, all children should be introduced to, you know, Gemara and Halacha, because some will go on and make a career of this, you know. But for my children, it was not enough. It's not enough. It was, they...
Do you find that Kasriel was basically the more artistic, literary, visual, rather than maybe the science and math kid
absolutely.
Study?
Absolutely.
And he wasn't appreciated, or none of these strengths were built on, and it was just sort of like a square peg in a round hole?
For sure. Yes, absolutely.
And do you find that a lot of the schools basically are really meant for just the square, the round hole, and if they, there's very little accommodation for those who are sort of different?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So do you think that if we had had ways to screen younger children and say these kids are a little bit different, then maybe they're more visual, they like arts, they're into feelings, they love music. Do you think maybe Castriel would be alive today if we had those programs?
Nobody should be in pain. No child should grow up and have to struggle in pain of, you know, social isolation or any of these things. And I think a lot can be done. And it's really education, and we can do it because we have a close-knit community. We don't have to deal with the whole world. We have to deal with our community. And I think it's a big plus that we have that.
Do you think as a community maybe we judge too much and are a little too critical?
Yes. It was interesting. I listened to the podcast with Mr. Klein speaking on Tisha B'Av. I just happened to come across it. I was listening, and I had known already the story because one of my children had driven their friend to the Levaya. My heart goes out to them. The whole day I felt so bad. This young girl passing away. It definitely hit home. And I heard about it on the day of the Levaya. So I came across the podcast. So I was listening to it on Tisha B'Av. And I keep thinking, like, we're in Gullis now. I think the way I learned it is because of Sinas Chinam, which we got everything else as a collectively, we got the rest of the stuff we got down, you know, as it's this one thing, it seems to be our sticking point, and we haven't got it right yet, or else we'd be home. I think that this is a very big thing, and this is our biggest challenge, probably.
Thank you very much. I hope that you have nachas from your children and
your
shama of your son should have an aliyah, and we're going to play this, and maybe other parents will become more aware.
Amen.
Okay?
Thank you so much. It was an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We have on the phone with us Rav Yaakov Berman. He's the director of Operation Survival in Crown Heights, which deals with the prevention of overdose, education of drug management. He'll tell us what he does. Welcome, Rabbi Berman.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rabbi Berman, could you tell us, like in a short sentence or two, what is Operation Survival? What is your mission?
Operation Survival is a prevention-based program primarily. Our goal is to go into schools, into yeshivas and also public schools in Crown Heights, and to teach kids life skills and prevention techniques that will hopefully prevent them from taking drugs at a later date. Evidence-based studies have shown, years ago we believed that the way you stop a kid from taking drugs is you tell them to say no, you go into the school and you teach them that heroin's bad. And the studies have proven that that's not effective. The effective thing to do is really to address the issue the kid is struggling with, whether it's an issue at home, whether it's an issue in school, whether the kid has emotional issues, and help them teach them how to make correct positive decisions and teach them positive action, and that will hopefully give them the ability to make the right decision when they're challenged with drugs at a later date.
So, Rabbi Berman, what inspired you to do this? What event or what did you see that said, I have to do this? What pain? What grabbed you and said, I'm not becoming a shaliach, whatever, a holy Chabad school would do. I'm dedicating my life to this. What caused that?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, we recently started a naloxone program, which is an overdose prevention program where we train parents in naloxone, which essentially naloxone is a drug. If somebody's is going into an overdose, naloxone reverses the overdose. So if their heart stops beating because of the opioid, naloxone will reverse the opioid and allow them to breathe again. It essentially saves lives. And I was inspired to start the naloxone program. When we started it, there was no other Jewish naloxone program in New York. And, it was just in the streets, the pain on the streets, everybody in this community and in Crown Heights, which is a Chabad community, everybody knows somebody who lost somebody from drugs. whether it's an opioid or alcohol overdose or other drugs, or unfortunately, or mental health, we all know, we even know somebody, or we know somebody who lost a family member from drugs. And on social media and elsewhere, you know, you see the cries of parents and friends. I don't want to go into too many details of the specific case I'm going to address, but there was a young individual in our neighborhood that died, and they were from a prominent family, and the friends, we're talking about hundreds of kids that this individual grew up with over the years, were affected, absolutely devastated. I guess that when somebody has a friend who dies and you grow up with this individual, you feel, what could I have done to prevent their death? And after the fact, there's a lot of guilt. And I felt, what could I have done if only somebody nearby had an naloxone kit and would have given this individual naloxone? It's possible that the death would have been prevented.
So what pain is driving children to do this?
A child going through a transitional period, any extreme trauma, any transitional period with a lot of stress in the child, could drive a child to experiment with drugs.
Give us an example.
Mr. Lichtenstein, I want to tell you, there's an evidence-based study which they took a classroom management in first grade. Proper classroom management in first grade could potentially affect whether the child in 10th grade will experiment with drugs. If there's rules, and the rebbes keep to the rules, and the teachers keep to the rules, and it's across the board fear. A child understands right from wrong, but when a rebbe in the classroom is just shooting from the hip, and for one day the punishment is this, and the next day the punishment is that, the child has no idea of right or wrong, and he thinks, you know, that could essentially affect whether or not he's going to experience. It sounds like, wow, what is first grade classroom? How does that affect? But when I say there are studies, there are evidence-based studies. There's actual data that demonstrate that as young as pre-1A first grade, how their teacher relates to them could affect whether they're going to experiment at a later date. But if you're going to ask me about why is there we see sort of an epidemic, you know, it's across the nation, and I guess that, you know, we're even in the Orthodox community, we're affected by what happens outside the community, and there's a lot of drugs available, and it's in the news, and it's glorified in certain segments of society, and kids that are struggling, you want to try it out. They think it may be a relief.
And what are they struggling with? Give us some examples. You say kids are struggling. What are they struggling? I'm in my 50s. What are today's kids struggling with?
It could be anything from family dynamics, poverty, environment. It could be.
Go through that. Go through them. Just find family dynamics.
All right. So let's go through some of these things. So I would say risk factors. There's something called risk factors and protective factors. I know it sounds scientific, but they've discovered different risk factors in a child, which or in a family, which may potentially affect their you know whether or not they're going to use drugs. So first of all, the first big risk factor is if a family member is an addict or engages in substance abuse, it's much more likely for the child to engage. This is true both because they view their family member as a role model. It's also true because the drugs may be available in the house. And there's also a genetic component that it's possible that the person has, somebody who's brought up and born to a family member that it has a drug addiction. They may have a genetic inheritance. They may be predisposed to become an addict. So that's automatically a high risk if you have a family member, if you have a sibling who's an addict. It's much more likely that this child may experiment than somebody who grew up in a family where they have no addiction or they have no access. Poor family management, harsh or severe punishments with children, shows a higher risk for substance use and other problems. Parents' failure to provide clear expectations or to monitor children's behavior is more likely. Higher level of conflict, if there's conflict in the family. whether it's the child is a part of that conflict or whether the child just is exposed to the conflict. You know, there's something very interesting also that parental attitudes have a huge effect on drugs. I know when it comes to underage alcohol, children or young teens where their parents are very clear that they oppose alcohol use, excessive alcohol, are much less likely to experiment and to drink. So if the parents are very clear with their children and say, this is wrong, this is dangerous, I won't tolerate it, it's much less likely for the child to go in. And because children, especially in our community, care, you know, at age 14, they care what their parents say. And if parents are clear and they're open about the dangers of drugs and they're clear with their kids, you know, the child is less likely to experiment and take this drug.
You mentioned poverty. How would poverty be a cause?
Well, the child is struggling. He doesn't have stability. Anything that may affect stability will affect whether they may potentially use. You know, when I say poverty, when I'm mentioning the risk factors I'm mentioning are based on data. I'm telling you nationally recognized. And we see communities where there's a lot of poverty. There's more crime. There's more in the secular community. There's more teen pregnancy. There's more school dropouts. A child who comes from a home where there's no food at night, you know, and he's not sleeping properly, it's more likely he's going to sleep through class and be distracted by other issues and worries, and may possibly drop out of school. And you know, in the yeshiva system, we also have sometimes some families that the kids can't afford to go to a mainstream school, or the schools won't take the kids, and they're on the streets. And not having stability, not having a daily schedule and routine, is also a high risk for drugs.
So have you personally? I mean, have you gone? Have you seen this firsthand, like the funerals of children who died of drugs?
I have. Unfortunately, I have, and. It's traumatic. What can I say? You know, if I had to say something to parents, I would say that you could do everything right, and you can't control what happens. That yes, there's so much we could do as community members, as you know, to change in the prevention area, awareness, community norms. There's so much we could do. Simple things, even in shul on a simchas Torah. We don't allow 40-year-old Bachram to, you know, unfortunately in Lubavitch, there over the years there have been Bachram that died from alcohol, and it's, I think, unacceptable that our society allows excessive alcohol drinking across the Jewish community, not just in Lubavitch. Simchas Torah, I mean, what happens in Simchas Torah in the Jewish community is unacceptable, and simple things like limiting alcohol in a shul in Simchas Torah could have a major effect. You never know. And so, although there are things we can do to prevent drugs and addiction, and there are things we should be doing, not everything we can control. And you can have a perfect family, a kid who goes to a perfect school, and is a mainstream bachur in yeshiva, and he'll be in a group with friends, and somebody will take something out and they'll experiment. I know a kid in Crown Heights who is a mainstream boy, had a job, part of a good family. And, you know, he experimented once, and that one time was bad drugs, and it killed him. And he did not have an issue before. Somebody said, why don't you try this? And for some reason, I guess he was in whatever mood he was in, whatever environment he was exposed to, the friends he was with, you know, they thought, why not? Let's try it out. It's cool. And he tried it out, and it killed him. So you can't blame the parents, you can't blame the family, you can't blame society. Whose fault is it? They, you know, whatever happened, something happened, and somehow this kid was exposed, and you know, there was nothing that would have implied or indicated or even hinted this kid is a risk, but it just happened.
So is your message saying that, one, we have to be as a community very vigilant, and keeping the family stable, educating teachers, making sure that teachers that aren't educated are either removed from the class or re-educated, and additionally, you could do everything, and then bad things can just happen. I mean, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and parents should not beat themselves up if they've done what they could and then life got in the way?
It's exactly my message. I think that you could do everything right, even when a kid is addicted. You know, I said an extreme case where there was a one-time use, but there's cases where kids are addicted and the parents pay for thousands of dollars for rehab. We had recently a case in New York where the community got together, sent the kid to rehab, and the kid left rehab. If the child's over 18, there's very little you could do. And unfortunately, there was a tragic end. Now, if you want to ask me what's the single most important issue in the Jewish community today, I would say that classroom management. Our schools do not have a system across the board. In, at least in the schools that I'm familiar with, every Rebbe has his own set of rules. And you know, in second grade, in Rabbi this, it's you know, the Rebbe does this, and then the next Rabbi has a different set of rules, and third grade Rebbe has a different set of rules. And I think that we have to adopt standards across the board that kids have to understand right from wrong. It should not be a Rebbe shooting from the hip. There has to be standards. That's number one, and policies and procedures that everybody follows. And the second thing is, I think, community norms, just awareness. We did a campaign in Crown Heights a few months ago. We all the stores on Kingston Avenue gave out shopping bags that said, teach kids to refuse to use, with the image of don't use drugs. And, you know, and I got a lot of negative feedback. I got a lot of positive feedback. People said to me, this is great work. Thank you. Somebody called me up and said my mother died from an overdose 30 years ago, and I was embarrassed to talk about it. Now, for the first time, I'm not embarrassed anymore because everybody's holding teach kids to refuse to use bags. I feel like this is a community problem. We don't have to hide it anymore. On the other, but parents came to me and said, how dare you put that on a shopping bag that my kid, who's Mr. Perfect, has to see it? And my message to them was, tell your kid not to use bad things. If the kid's in second grade, you don't have to tell them, teach them about heroin. Say there are certain drugs or foods that are bad for you, and you shouldn't use it. And I think that the challenge in the Krum community is, and the pushback is, that do you expose kids to drugs? Do you expose everybody and expose kids that wouldn't be exposed otherwise? Or do you target kids at risk and only you know, address drugs to them? And the problem is that essentially if you don't see the risk and you know the risk is not picked up on, then and those kids, you know, the issues won't be addressed.
That's, you know, it's Rabbi Berman, it's a general, it's a debate, and we should have some educators talk about it. Is
right.
Do we talk about pornography,
right,
internet, drugs? What do we say? By talking about it, we're in a way sanctioning it as a possibility. Whereas if we never talk about it, it's like it never even becomes part of our conversation.
That's a valid point. I don't think the concern that I've heard is not so much sanctioning as a possibility, more exposing the kids to something they don't know about. So if somebody has a family, they have no TV in the house, they have no radio, and they've kept the kids sort of sheltered from the secular world, they feel that if their Rebbe gets up and says, you know, there's something called heroin, and it's very dangerous, and if you take it, this could happen, you're exposing the kid to something he's never heard of. But I would say, it's my view, in today's society, at least in a mainstream community, the chances are the kid's going to be exposed anyway, and it's important to talk about it, and it's worth the risk, because I think that, again, the evidence has shown that when we target full classrooms and we teach the entire population a concept, it's much more effective than just going after the at-risk, because many, you know, we're not always successful. And separating at-risk youth from the larger population also has a risk. You know, something very interesting, when we teach drug education in the schools and yeshivas, we don't call it drug education. We call it life skills. We call it positive action. The parents have no idea that the kids are even going for drug education because we don't want to deal with the stigma. We say, listen, we'll teach the kids about drugs, we'll teach the kids about life skills, but we don't have to call it drug education. We'll call it a life skill class. And when we did our prevention event in Crown Heights, we had 650 people. I called it a drug prevention event instead of a drug intervention event, because that way a parent could say, I'm there for prevention. I'm not here. My child has no issue. We gave them a way out, sort of. They don't have to acknowledge the issue, and they could still come in and participate.
Rabbi Berman, in your opinion, how many of the Fruma kids will at some point be exposed to drugs, either through a friend or classmate? We had Rabbi Lapian on, I interviewed recently, from Lev Aryeh, and he said 80% of boys are exposed to pornography by the time they're 20,
right,
which is an astonishing number. What would you say, what percentage of boys have some type of, at some point, have the opportunity to be, through equipment, et cetera, to be exposed to drugs?
You're saying opioids in particular or any drug?
I honestly don't know much about drugs.
I'll tell you what, in Crown Heights on Labor Day, you walk down the street, everybody's exposed. Everybody sees it, drugs. If you're including your prescription medicine, then I would say then to almost every child in Crown Heights at some point in time is going to have somebody in their family that's taking a prescription drug, an opioid, a painkiller.
I'm talking about it sort of illegally, like what we would.
But that's illegally. If a high school kid is popping their parents' pills, that's illegally. Today, they're just as dangerous. And oxycodone, you start with oxycodone, you move on to heroin, but you could overdose from an oxy easily. It's not like they're less dangerous. They're advising parents to lock up their medicine now. Kids, a lot of times, experiment. They start off with pills. It's easier to get,
So you say that almost all children, almost all boys anyway, will at some point in their teen years come across drug use?
I think they'll be exposed 100%. I think almost all boys will be exposed, whether it means an older brother's friend who passed from an overdose, whether it means pain meds and trying a pain med in the medicine cabinet, or whether it means walking down the street and seeing somebody shooting up heroin or they themselves experimenting. I would say most of the community is already exposed. The websites are reporting these overdoses. Many of our youth are reading these websites and they're exposed. Is it bad exposure? Not always is it bad exposure, but to be exposed, 100%. In the shtetl, they weren't exposed like they're being exposed today. But across the country, children are being exposed. It's not unique to our community.
So it seems that one of the challenges of our generation is that the world is changing very fast, much faster maybe than it has in the past. I mean, just look at the iPhone. It's astonishing, what we would can do this, what a computer that was the size of a room can now be done on an iPhone. The world, and both as parents and mechanchim, when I grew up, a lot of my rabbeim were in their 80s. They came off the boat. Today, we, as parents, educators, we just have to become much smarter, much quicker about a world that has changed, and kids are exposed to things that we never dreamed. And if we just put our heads under the carpet, we make believe it doesn't exist, we're not protecting our kids or educating our kids.
Even more so, I would say that if we bury our heads in the sand, then we have blood on our hands. If in fact we could save a life, and sometimes it's not a huge, some of the things we could do to affect change are not major things. If we all participate as a community, we could affect change. And if we could save one life, and we don't, and we have this child's blood on our hands, what's our excuse?
I heard over a verse, we say twice al chait on Yom Kippur. There's the al chait that we say in the tefillah of the Amidah, of the, the quiet Shemon Esrei, and then we say repeat al chait again by the Hoichah Shemon Esrei, right? And the Velt says, the lamdim of the Velt say, they say that there's two types of chatoim that we do. One that we do that affect ourselves. We affect our own kedusha, our shama, our tahara, our etc. And then there's the separate chait that we do that's a communal chait. Where was I when that boy was doing something that I could have hugged him or said something to him, and he did, and I didn't. I didn't support him, and look what it did. what action have I done that has caused somebody else in the community, Rahman al-Atsan, to get hurt by it because he was inspired by my bad behavior? So that's the chait of the Haichishman. We say as a community, where as a community have we failed each other? And the message that you're saying is that if we don't educate ourselves, we have blood on our hands because of the impact it could have on our children or on our neighbors' children.
Exactly. And I'll say even more that, you know, studies, there's evidence also that community attachments, religion, is all a protective factor, and it makes it less likely for a child to experiment if he has a strong community attachment. He's involved in any religion, and especially a Yiddishkeit. I think another great challenge we have is rabbinic integrity. Our rabbanim disrespect each other, they're fighting, and children grow up without rabbinic integrity today, and they question, when they start questioning their religion, this also could have an effect, and we have to stop fighting. We have to stop fighting with each other, start respecting each other, and start respecting institutions, start respecting, all everything going on in the Haredi world today between Rebbes and between Rabbanim, it's costing us lives. People are dying as a result.
Rabbi Berman, thank you very much. Rabbi Shalom should give you kayach to continue in your Avodas HaKadosh.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's Lacha Rabba.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from New Jersey, Rabbi Joseph Oritz, who is the principal of Berea High School, which is one of the preeminent high schools in the entire New York, New Jersey area. Welcome, Rabbi Oritz.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to schmooze with you.
So, Rabbi Oritz, here's the question. As an educator, how does one balance the best interests of a child vis-a-vis the needs of a school to maintain either a certain academic standard or a certain behavioral standard? Times when we send a kid out of school, it could really have life-changing impact on the child. So,
right.
You know, there are a few areas, except maybe a doctor or, you know, who's an oncologist, but very few of us have such life and death power over people. And, you know, you're a respected and serious educator. So maybe you could just walk us through it.
Okay, so first of all, it's really a timely question, and I really want to, first of all, thank you for having me on, and second of all, thank you for dealing with these kinds of issues. It's really a tremendous help to the Jewish community. And the issue that you're raising is really incredibly complex, and as a general overview, because it's so complex, it needs everyone on board whenever we're dealing with a child, whenever we're dealing with a neshama, so everyone is involved. It can't just be one, it's not just the parents, it's not just the school, it's the parents together with the school, together with the mental health professionals, together with the community rabbonim, and together with the community lay leaders and the askanim. Everyone together has to work in tandem to whatever the issue happens to be, in every single area, whether it's issues of tuition, whether it's issues of children who need special academic needs, whether it's children who are dealing with at-risk behavior in terms of their own physical health or emotional health, whether they're dealing with depression or anxiety, whether they're just struggling with family relationships. And all of those, the school gets to see it because we have them in our building for the better part of the day. But it really is everyone together has to work together to find the right solution for each child. So that's the general overview. You raised an interesting challenge, which is what happens when the needs of the child conflict with the needs of the school. A student and that's where we as educators really begin to sweat it out, if you will, because we are completely committed to the needs of the child, and we're also completely committed to the needs of everybody else in the school. And how we navigate through that becomes incredibly difficult.
Let me give you a few scenarios and walk me through them. Judge Fryer wrote an article, and she said that Malki was accepted into a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 days or a few days before, they sent her, "I'm sorry, we're not accepting you." And he said, four parents in the class called up the principal and basically said, you know, if she comes, it just doesn't say good things about your school. So we're going to pull our kid if you accept her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you react to parents' demand like that?
Okay. So first of all, I think it's really important that we, if we can, have the conversation, not about any, we don't know all the circumstances surrounding any particular situation. I know in your conversation with Rabbi Eichenstein that you had on your had on this past Matzei Shabbos. So you brought up a case of a principal who was dealing with a particular situation, and the challenge. I have no doubt that the information that we may be aware of is only partial information. We don't know the whole story. We don't know exactly what was going on. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So we're a little bit in a difficult situation when you're dealing with any specific child, because we don't know, or we just don't have all the information. So we really have to sort of generalize this into something much, much more general. And I think that in almost every case where I've asked a Shiloh regarding a child attending my school or not, or being asked out of school, the criteria was very straightforward. You know, I would never ask a child out of my school if I didn't speak to a POSIC. And the POSIC asked me various kinds of questions. And inevitably, the only time that I was allowed to ask a child out of a school when we were dealing with a situation where that child was endangering other children. If they were endangering other children, then the POSIC said that you not only may ask them out, but sometimes I was told I'm required, I'm chayev to ask them out.
How would you, as an educator, react to parents who said, "I don't want my child with that child. She's not smart enough. She's not miyuchas enough. She's, you know, any one of the reasons where it's not endangering the other children." How would you, as an educator, what would you tell those parents?
Okay, so Baruch Hashem, I haven't had to deal with that specific, those kinds of specific objections, if you will. And generally, if a child belongs in my school, then they belong in my school. And I don't think if I would ask a Shiloh, which I wouldn't because it wouldn't really make a difference to me what the other parents are saying in that those kinds of cases. If I would ask a Shiloh, I would be told very clearly what they do or don't want. I'm not the POSIC, but I've never asked a specific Shiloh, but I can imagine that most poskim would say to me that the criteria for taking a child into a school is not whether other parents happen to like or not like that child. We definitely have had situations where we were told, "Oh my gosh, if you take that child, some of the other kids in the school are going to be upset." And my response has been, "Okay, I understand they might be upset. We'll work with them, and we'll get them to see the bigger picture, and we'll work it out."
Do you find the attitude offensive?
I don't know where all the parents are coming from. Again, we're back into that situation where I don't understand what exactly is going on in their mind. If you're saying to me, my child doesn't belong in class with that child, and there's only one class, so then it's a question of explaining to the parent that the different children have different needs, and we as a school are going to see to it that your child gets what he or she needs, and this other child is going to get what he or she needs. If they're coming and saying this child is going to hurt my child because of their presence in the building, because they're going to bring in outside influences that my child hasn't been exposed to, they're going to chas v'shalom bring in substances that or introduce them to substances, that's a completely different question. Otherwise, I think the response of most mechanchem would be, I think that we need to work this out. That's why I'm saying that in that particular case of that you're bringing up, we don't know all the information, so we have no idea.
I'm talking, and I'm not even want to talk about that case because it's not for me, God forbid, to pass judgment on anybody. And if I gave that impression, I apologize. But we do have, you know, Shlomi Yehuda Rechnitz gave a long speech last year, which got 100,000 views, and he spoke about parents who say, my child should be with that child. Look at his father. He look what he does. He's a truck driver. He's a plumber. He works for the sanitation department. My child should be with that child if the parents, the schnur is. My child should be, that child is overweight. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I'll just tell you a quick story that my uncle, Zichron Levracha, told me, my uncle, the Fry Moratz, who was a mechanech par excellence, and he told me the story of, and I want to make sure that I don't misquote him. So he was referring to one of the Hasidic rebbes who was told that they're going to make separate classes in the school that I believe his granddaughter was going to. They were going to make, the Beis Yaakov was going to make separate classes one class for those whose fathers were in learning, and another class for those whose fathers were working. And he, the Rebbe, went to the principal and sat down with him and said, "Okay, I understand your policy. I'd like my granddaughter to be in the class with the girls whose fathers are working." As if to say, and of course they changed the policy right after that, because if the Rebbe didn't agree with it, then as if to say that's not a criteria for separating children. So my guess would be that we could extrapolate from that that the criteria has to be what exactly is the influence that we're talking about. If it's an influence where someone's going to bring in outside influences that are going to be detrimental to a child, that's one thing. If you're saying that it happens to be that the parents have a slightly different hashkafa, then that's completely different. One of the things that we do here, Bedafka, and it's not for everyone, I agree, is that we have children coming from different kinds of backgrounds who all discover that 98% of the time we're in agreement. There's a few places where we disagree, but fundamentally, Torah Messinai, we agree on the fact that we have to give proper respect to Torah and Rabbonim and our Moros. You know, we agree on the fact that the Shulchan Aruch, is the way we run our lives. We agree on. So there are a few different hashkafic issues that some of the girls disagree, and lo and behold, they discover that even though that girl comes from a different kind of home than I am, she davens beautifully, she's careful about about how she dresses, she's respectful to her teachers. Okay, so they have hashkafa about, let's say, the Medina that we don't have or something like that. But fundamentally, we're all in agreement. So they can go to school together and they learn beautifully from each other. And dafka, they grow from each other. They don't hurt each other. They end up growing from each other. On the other hand, if you have a child who's coming in and bringing in the negative influences, so that starts to become a real challenge.
So wait, let me ask you one question, and we'll go to the more extreme case. What do you say to a mechanach? And this happened to me when I lived in Lakewood. There was a girl on my block who went to a high school. That's one of the oldest high schools in town. And after Sukkot, they sent her home because her parents couldn't afford the tuition. Her father was an Arman. They lived in a very humble abode, etc. And I went to see the principal. And, it was a partnership. Two people owned the school, private school, which is unfortunate when schools become private and principals have absolute power. And he said to me, "Mr. Lichtenstein, what business are you in?" I said, "I'm in apartment houses." He says, "When a tenant doesn't pay, you throw them out." He said, "My business is the school business, and when a girl doesn't pay, I throw her out." And would you, if I told you the tenant is standing on the street crying, would you then say, "Okay, live for free"? You wouldn't. So why, if the girl is home for 6 weeks in this case crying, why should I take her back? This is your business, and this is my business. And this was a principal who's had that attitude for many years. And what would you respond? How do you respond?
I can't speak to that particular case, but I think you said it. You said it before when you introduced the case. As one of the challenges in having private schools, which everyone is certainly entitled to do, is that you end up in that exact situation. I happen to be in a situation where we're dealing with a community school, and that's why I pointed out that really this is, everyone has to be on board here, because obviously if it's a community school, then the entire community, and not just one community, but the entire supporting community of that particular school, then has to take responsibility. And if they're coming from outside the community into a community school than the community from which they come. It becomes a Kahilisha problem when a parent can't pay tuition. Now, I do want to emphasize that that's when a parent can't pay tuition, as opposed to a parent who simply ignores the request. But
a parent who can pay tuition, if you were talking to that principal, would you say, I agree with that position, you know, businessmen expect to be paid, and if they don't, you evict somebody, and the same thing with a child? Or would you think there's any difference? If you were just talking to that principal, what would your position be?
Because I don't deal in private schools that are privately owned.
I mean, when I say privately owned, they're all 501c3s. As far as the government concerns, they're not profit. They make dinners where they invite everybody from the tzibur. So, yes, they're privately owned, not according to law and not morally, but they're privately owned. The respect is that the board is a sister-in-law, a brother-in-law, a nephew, a child of this. So they're really not privately owned, but they're, for all ipso facto, privately owned. They take the benefit of a tax-free and they're non-profit and write-offs, but it's really privately owned in a practical way.
But in fact, it's a school that's built in a community in order to make sure that the girls or boys in that community have a Torah chinuch. That's why the school exists, is it not?
Right. So what would you respond to a principal like this?
Speaking in a vacuum, again, I'm going to say that until I have a conversation with that particular principal, mechanech to mechanech, not parent to mechanech, not community member to mechanech, but mechanech to mechanech, and I have that conversation, that's the only time that I'd be able to respond, because I'm going to go back to my first point. Something tells me, knowing how the system works, that there's more than meets the eye. And it could be that the explanation is they haven't paid tuition. That could very well be the explanation. No, that's the public explanation. And it also might be that there's other things going on
that we can't be aware of. Yeah, but when the father went collecting, actually, raised the money, paid the parents, and they let it right back in. And this is the policy of the school. You know, no ticky, no shirty. You know, you don't walk out of a grocery with a bottle of milk that you can't pay for, and don't bring your child here and then fall behind on your payments. It's policy.
Okay, so since it would seem to me that since, in fact, it is a nonprofit school, which means they're counting on raising funds from the community, is that correct?
Yes, clearly.
Okay, then it's not this, then it is, it becomes the school's, the community's responsibility to see to it that no child is out of school. If it's in fact a community school, then the community, including the school, because the school is part of the community, has to take that responsibility. It's not one person's or one institution's responsibility. It becomes everyone's responsibility.
And therefore, do you send the child home or not?
That's a different question. Now we have a completely different issue. We have a child who isn't paying tuition. Now what do you do? But it certainly would seem to be that the next step, and again, I don't know how many steps were taken in any of these cases. I have no idea how many times and how many different people the school approached to work out the situation and what exactly the financial situation of the family is like. We don't know way too much information to be able to say the school's at fault for not taking them in, for sending them home.
Let me ask you a question. The Gemara says Do you think the principal was Mekayim, was he Mapel himself with Kifshon Shalesh? Did he rise to that value before he sent the kid home?
So I don't know the circumstances under which the child was quote unquote sent home. Okay, because I don't know those circumstances. But I do know that the complete guilt at the feet of the school may not be correct, because again, you're not and you do not know all the information. So you have no idea how many different times this principal tried. And as it turns out, the principal was willing to bend over backwards in three and four different ways and wasn't met anywhere. We have no idea if they were met even at in the middle, where they met at 80%, you know, where the school was once vacated. We don't know where what the rest of the community did or didn't do. So how is it only the school's responsibility? Why isn't it also the general community's responsibility to see to it? And maybe the community ignored the situation. Maybe the Rabbanim and the community did absolutely nothing. Maybe the Askanim of the community did absolutely nothing. So then it becomes the community's responsibility, not only the schools. I'm not saying the school is completely out of it, but everyone needs to take, and in all of these cases, whether it's a tuition case, whether it's a substance abuse case, whether it's a, you know, in any of them, it's a team effort. If everyone's not involved, then somebody, you know, everyone needs to be involved in order to get this to work.
Okay, so let's go to a situation where you have a child who comes to school and their behavior is not up to par, right? The child has pick your favorite thing. She hangs out with boys. She was caught drinking at home once or twice. What do you do when you say it's not up to the school standards? What's the next step?
Okay, so I think that the protocol needs to be as follows. This needs to be in writing. Okay, when a child is in trouble. All right, whatever it happens to be, extreme behavioral, you know, issues, or let's say drinking at home or something like that. So again, I'll draw the line between their own problem and causing others a problem. So let's assume for the moment that we're talking about the case that you just described. When we discover that a child is in trouble with one of these things, our first thing we do is call the child in, have a conversation, call the parents in, have a conversation, and get them the help that they need. Make sure that they are finding an appropriate therapist, social worker, whatever, a mental health professional that is going to begin the process of helping them through. And as long as they are willing to go for help and get the help that they need, and it might be the whole family needs it, or at least the parents with the child, there's a lot of different possibilities there, then we will continue to work with that child. And just as long as we know that they are continuing to get the help that they need. If the child continues that, that's great, and we hope that they get, you know, they can work out whatever issues they have. If they continue to have difficulties, we'll continue to work with them because they're continuing to try to work it out. If they stop trying to work it out, so now we lost our partner. If the parents aren't willing to get them the help that they need, or the child refuses to go for help, so now how do we fix it? Because now no one's trying to fix it anymore. That puts us in a much more difficult situation. Because if we don't fix it.
Is it three strikes and you're out, sort of?
Each case is individual. Each case is individual. The most difficult case is the one where the child starts to involve their friends, their classmates. Because that goes back to that original thing that I had said a few minutes ago. Okay, so now you're hurting other people. So now, although asking you out of the school could be, you know, one of the worst things for you, you know, child, you know, this particular child, we now have to take into account the safety of the other children in the school. What we will do, very, you know, when we have those kinds of situations, is we have to sort of navigate between the child's needs to continue in school and everyone else's needs to be separated. It's sort of like this child needs a time out from everyone else. So there are ways to arrange for each student to continue to do school, but not necessarily to come to the building. So there are various online courses that they can take. We can send work home. So we keep them busy so that they have what to do. They're not losing out on a year's worth of work or part of a year's worth of work, so that they can finish the year and have a transcript to be able to, if they need to, transfer to another school. It's not as if they're missing a half a year's worth of school. But at the same time, we've removed them from a situation where they run the risk or are already harming other children.
Now, a child who is, let's say, caught something that you would consider harming other children, let's say like drinking, would they be given the opportunity also to get in line, to get help, et cetera, or is there
– Yeah, of course. It's two separate things. One is to keep the other children safe, and the second thing, and both simultaneously, to make sure that this child is getting the help that they need. That's where the outside mental health professions and Shul Rabbanim come in, you know, very, very strongly, because the Rabbanim are the ones who have a relationship with the family. They need to sit down with the family and explain to them, your child can't be back in the building because the activity that your child's engaged in that has been now, that she has involved other people in, so that requires her not to be in the building anymore. But at the same time, you need to do whatever you need to do in order to keep your child safe and healthy, so let's get her the help that she needs. So the school will make recommendations. The school will get on the phone if they are taking the child to a mental health professional to explain to them what was going on in the building so that they can know where to start from or where to work with this child. Okay.
Is there a zero tolerance towards anything?
Yeah, the zero tolerance is when you're hurting other children. So if you are, Rahman Litzlan, selling drugs, if you are enabling other children to do something illegal. Okay, so if you're underage, which in America is under 21, if you in a particular home were offering alcohol to a minor, okay, so those are things where, so if you're drinking, so you have a problem. If you're causing other people to drinking, now you've put yourself in a situation where you're causing harm to others.
So can I ask you a question, Rabbi Yerz? If I'm home mm-hmm. Shabbos, mm-hmm. and we serve wine by the meal, and there's a bunch of, I don't know, girls there, or boys,
right.
who are 18, is this like, that's it? You're out of
so
school?
Because there's obviously a huge difference between having wine for Kiddush and
during the meal,
out.
Not for Kiddush, during the meal.
Yeah, so everything in moderation. So if someone put out, let's say, you know, a regular bottle of wine, and there were 10 people around the room, and everybody, you know, had a half a cup of wine. Okay. I mean, I don't think that's grounds for asking anyone out, because, you know, I think that's done in many homes, and no one would necessarily, I'm not saying it's legal. I have no idea what the legalities are. So, you know, but I don't think that anybody considers that to be, you know, out of the ordinary. However,
I mean, in France, it would be considered barbaric not to serve wine.
To serve the wine, okay, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, so there are legal, you know, precedents in terms of being able to serve wine at a meal that's considered a sacred meal or something like that. So certainly, you know, Kiddush wine is certainly okay. Now we're not talking about that. We're talking about kids who get together on a Friday night after the meal and after the parents have gone to sleep, and all of a sudden they're raiding the parents' liquor cabinet. The parents are in the house. They did not lock the liquor cabinet. And all of a sudden the kids have a bottle of scotch out on the table, and they're drinking shots of scotch.
So
that's a great thing,
because there's a lot of drinking that goes on in yeshivas.
Right.
A few boys get together, they raid the parents' cabinet.
Right.
They're back from Eretz Yisrael. They're all 18. It's Bein Hazmanim. They do shots, they take two, three drinks, two drinks, what's the halakha?
So I can't speak
principle.
I can't speak for post high school. I have no idea. I'm not going to.
In high school, in 11th grade.
In high school, if there were a group of kids who got together and the parents simply allowed them to drink in the house without, and so if a parent was in the room and they each had one shot and the parent put the bottle away, I don't think we'd even hear about it. The problem comes is that the kids get drunk, and then we hear about it because they start staggering around the street. Now, where did that happen? It happened in so-and-so's house, so so-and-so is responsible, both legally, by the way, all right, and as far as we're concerned from a school perspective, they're responsible as well. Not so much the kids who drank. That's a different issue.
So let's talk about the kids who drank. I want to narrow it down. I'm giving you a misa. You have a yeshiva. There's 11th grade boys. It's Friday night, the parents are sleeping, they raid the liquor cabinet, and each one of them has two shots of alcohol. Johnny
okay.
Walker Red, the best stuff.
What's the
halacha? You're the paisik.
Okay, so I'm not going to paskin on all of them together. I'm going to paskin them one at a time. Because obviously we're dealing with Dina Nefashos here, and Dina Nefashos is one at a time. Okay, have they been warned? Is this the first time, first offense? Is this something that's already been ongoing, that the school is already working with this child on, and now the child is ignoring the
let's say it's the first time. So let's walk through.
First
time,
and the first timers, those are DAFCA the cases where we're sitting down with the family and saying, okay, this is what went on. You need to be aware of it. We don't know if it's a problem yet because it was one, as far as we know, it was one time. This is a conversation that you need to have with
your
child.
Now it's the second time. Great.
Okay,
now
the second time we're calling the parent in. So now we're probably up to a point where now we need to make sure that this child's getting the right help that they need. Okay?
And now it's the third time.
Okay, so I can't comment on the third time because the first time was a gentle reminder. The second time the child was put on to the protocols, right? Now you need to go
right.
get help. When you're already on the protocols and now you do it again, so now you're in a situation where we have to evaluate whether this is the best environment for you because you're obviously having a problem. So now we have to get serious, more serious about the kind of help that you need. And that's not now it's not clear. Now,
what point do we say you have to leave the school? What would be the line?
I think it changes from child to child, from parent to, from situation to situation.
So give me one situation. Give me just pick one because I want to ask some questions. I have to shall have ectomacy to be able to ask the question, right? Pick a case where you would ask a kid to leave.
Where the child decided not only to do this multiple times, we're already working with them, but after working with them and they've done this a couple of times, decided to post the information in a very, very public way. So that is no longer a private matter between me and this child. I'm working with them to try to help the child, but now the child has made it a public event.
So sort of
okay.
to breach
so now,
the authority.
Now it ends up happening.
To breach the authority of the school, in other words.
No, I'm not worried about the authority of the school. That's
okay.
a completely separate issue. It's really
okay.
a non-issue. Okay. What okay. I am concerned about is that now what you've done is that you have now, if the school does nothing, then the rest of the students in the school now read that as the school doesn't really, then there's no
yeah,
policy.
That's what
then
I mean.
Then
they,
it's mutter.
They,
it's mutter.
Yeah, they,
no.
They basically
no.
break the authority. They say the
no,
school,
no,
they make
no,
a litanus
no,
of the school.
But for a reason. The authority of the school is not, that's
no, it's
not,
to show that. Okay, let's
yeah,
dindle and dine.
What I'm concerned about is kolam yishmu v'yirou. In other words, how do I make sure that other kids don't make this mistake also? I have to make sure that they're not looking at this and saying,
okay.
there's nothing wrong with it, and therefore I can go and do it. Now by doing nothing, we end up causing other children to make really poor decisions, as opposed to, at the very least, they won't do it because they're afraid to get kicked out. At the very least.
Okay,
I mean,
so let me ask you, Rabbi Erz, let me go to this case, and I'm going to ask you some questions, okay? Rabbi Eichenstein said that, I believe he said this, that the Chazon Ish's opinion was, because I know the Chazon Ish has this in writing,
mm-hmm.
even if we throw out a child for doing damage to others, we're obligated to find another school for the child.
Okay, so hold it. Rabbi Eichenstein, but DAFCA did not deal with this case. I listened to that carefully. In
okay.
fact, it's very interesting that it's not only what he said, but what he didn't say. All right? Rabbi Eichenstein stopped short of saying that when you're causing harm to other children, right? Now, the general idea of trying to find another school for a child, and again, that's a not only a school's responsibility, but a communal responsibility. It's everyone's responsibility. But the school certainly should make an attempt, all right, to give advice, to give other possible schools that this child could apply to. So I agree with. But Rabbi Eichenstein, DAFCA did not deal with the case of someone who was causing other people harm, because the Chazon Ish's psak, when we're dealing with pikuach nefesh, was about this child. But we all know the rule that when it comes to a rodef, which is causing other people damage, then the rules change a little bit. And the psak that I've received when I've been Baruch Hashem not very often, but when I've been put in this situation where I've had a situation where the child is causing others harm, the psak that I've received is, as I said earlier, it's not just that I'm allowed to throw them out, I'm chayiv to ask them out because they're hurting other people.
Now, let me ask you a question. The Gemara says that Isaiah-ish, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Gemara says, who was it, Reb Chanina? I forgot who it was, but the Gemara says, Gehazi ve'Isaiah-ish, both times Elisha was Taya, that he was Dachfei le'Gehazi,
mm-hmm.
And the Gemara says, I forgot, I apologize, I don't have the Gemara Sanhedrin in front of me, was Taya because he was Dachfei to Yeshu, also B'shtei Adayim, and because of that, they did tremendous damage to Klal Yisrael as a whole. The
mm-hmm.
Shalmi says that Gehazi went ahead and he was the one who aided Yeravam ben Nevat to split off Klal Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
Yeshu, we know that, you know, we just sat through Tisha B'Av and we read the kinnises, the four kinnises that talk about the Crusades, the
mm-hmm.
terrible, the rejection, what it caused him to do.
Mm-hmm.
How do we weigh, on one hand, that there could be damage to children, and on the other hand, that when a child is publicly shamed, or for that matter, an adult is publicly shamed, that it can not only damage that person, but create communal damage as well, like both Yeshu and Gehazi did in the worst
right.
imaginable
so
way.
The third example,
by the way, would be Timna, who was rejected by the Avis, and she ended up mothering a Amalek, and Timna means rejected. And now in the case of Yeshu, we have to understand he was damaging others as well. So
right.
notwithstanding the fact that he was damaging others, Chazal said, you know, la'olam ye'ada mekarav b'yamin v'daicha b'smal, yamin mekarav v'daicha v'daicha, because to be daicha has such incredibly powerful, the shaming
right.
has such powerful things, besides the child, but even communal, so the
right.
very community that we're trying to protect can be damaged seriously by somebody who does this.
Which is why whenever the situation requires a child to be removed from school, that removal ultimately needs to be accompanied by everyone in the school reaching out to that child, not the ones who they already have a relationship with, to continue that relationship. So if I had a particular relationship with a child that I asked out of the school, and then I reached out to the child and said, if you want to talk, I know that you're angry at me now, but if you want to talk, if you want to go through the process, if you want to talk again, and sometimes they reach out because they can get past their anger, and sometimes they can't. But the teachers will very often just stay in touch with those. They're still their students. Just because a student was asked out of school doesn't mean she's not my talmida. She's still my talmida, even if I was required to ask her not to come back to school anymore. And by the way, that is the language that I would rather use than the language that people are using, because it's, I think, a very negative language of throwing a child out of school. I think what we're asking the child is, we're asking them, we care about you so, so much, but right now we can't have you in the building. So we're going to help you continue school. We're going to stay in touch with you. We'll send you work. We'll make shidduchim with you and other mechanchim or our own mechanchim. We'll spend time with you. But for now, you can't be in the building.
Okay, Rabbi, let me ask you another question. I don't know where I got this verbiage from, but you know, the Gemara says that a bezdin that kills once in 70 years is a bezdin
mm-hmm.
katlanis.
Mm-hmm.
Some say once in 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
When a school has to throw out, you know, numerous children, do we look at it as a failure of the children or a failure of the school?
I would say that there's two sides to that. On the one hand, when a school needs to ask out a number of children, so it could very well be that there was a supervision issue that the school failed on, and simultaneously, on the other side of the coin, if the school doesn't ask those children out, then that's a greater fail, because our responsibility is to first protect the students in our building, okay? And when we're confronted with that conflict of the needs of the individual child and the needs of the rest of the children in the building, unfortunately, the needs of the rest of the children have to come first. Now, that does not, you know, there's an interesting halacha. There's an interesting halacha that says that a child, when a parent asks a child to do an aveir, that the child's, you know, not required to listen. Okay?
Divrei Rabbah, Divrei Talmud, Divrei Mishaim.
No, it's straight up. Okay, it's halacha psuka.
Right.
So when I teach that to my children, when I teach that to my students, I say to them, but when you don't listen to your parent, You have to not listen with respect. In other words, you can't throw it in their face. Well, you're not allowed to tell me to do that because no. You have to very gently say to your friend, I'm really, really sorry. I feel very bad. I know that you want me to ignore that lost object, but what am I can't help it. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that I have to pick up the lost object. I'm really sorry, Abba. Apologetically, don't listen. When we ask a child out of the school, the pain, the crying that goes on, not to the child only, for us, the amount of turmoil, the inner turmoil that we go through before we ask a child out is indescribable. However, I can't tell that to the child because the child is in the middle of her own pain. So my pain is completely irrelevant. All I can do is cry with the child. I wish I could keep you here. I would do anything if I could keep you here. But right now, this has to be the way it goes.
Let me come back to my question. The Gemara says that a Beis Din that's 1 in 70 years is a katanis.
We're not talking about a Beis Din.
No, let me finish. I have a concept, a metaphor. So the Gemara says that, Rabbi Akiva said, if I was on the Beis Din, it would never. Why? Because I would say, which side of the sword is sharper? So we're talking about a Beis Din that is killing somebody
right.
who is a danger to others.
Right.
Right? We're talking about in a capital crimes case. And yet Rabbi Akiva said, what, more than once in 70 years is a Beis Din katlanis.
Right.
You see from the case with the sword that it's like a... So my question to you is, if a school throws out more than one child in 70 years, would you say it's a school katlanis? And if it is, then is it a reflection on the school that once you're here, we should be able to control you? That is our job. You're with us 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day, 10 a day, and is us as a school's failure? Or is it a Beis Din katlanis? It should be a society katlanis. Why are they raising murderers? But we don't. We say it's a Beis Din katlanis. So my question would be: Is it the school's failure? Is the school the katlanis, or is the society
okay,
the katlanis?
So here's very interesting. First of all, I thought I answered the question already. But second of all, Dafka the Beis Din is the representative of the community. So
right.
You could say that it's a community fail, as represented by the Beis Din.
Okay.
The school, however, is only one arm of the community. So it is it's a community fail. We're failing as a community because we make things so incredibly, the pressure on our teenagers is incredibly high, whether it's religious pressure, whether it's academic pressure, we're failing. But most importantly, the most important component, and any teenager will tell you this, is that they have to know that despite whatever is going on in their lives, someone is going to have some unconditional love for them. And when they feel there's no one around them who has unconditional love, so that creates a very difficult situation. But that has nothing to do with whether a child remains in the building or doesn't remain in the building. That's why I like to use the phrase, we say to them, you can't be in this building anymore. It's not that we're throwing you out of school. And for DAFCA, we don't throw kids out of school. I mean, there are cases where we do, but fundamentally, we're going to help you finish your year, just not in the building. So we're staying in contact with you. We are arranging for you to get the help that you need. We're talking with your parents to make sure that you get the help that you need. We're speaking to your rabbanim so that they can help your parents make sure that you get the help that you need. There's a lot of moving pieces that have to be involved when you're saying to a child, you can't be in the building anymore. And then after that, to help them as much as possible without lying to another school, to help them get into a different school. Sometimes they can't get into a school in their local community. It just won't work anymore because everybody in the community knows the situation, unfortunately, because people talk too much. All right, that's chaval. So sometimes they need to move out of the community and find a school or send a child away to school. But there are schools around the country that a child can go to. And it is partially the school's responsibility and partially the community's responsibility to help them get into those schools, absolutely.
So would you say then that it's fair to say that if you have a school that has like a sort of thrown out a fair amount of children over the last number of years, that it's both the schools and the community's failure?
I'm not sure why we're splitting hairs here. What does that mean?
I think that
the school is part of the community.
Okay. But I agree with you, but there also happens to be the parent here. They are the one. There are many parts. The baker is part of the community, and the butcher, they are the one who
has
the child.
No, you know what I mean, as institutionally part of the community. You have the schools, you have the shuls, all right, and the parents are intersect both of those, okay, and then you have the larger community in general, okay. So and you have the mental health services of a particular community. Every one of those need to be talking to every one of those for each individual child that's suffering, if you will. Okay, and help them through, because any child that's acting out this way is acting out this way because they're having a difficult time with something. They're not bad kids. They're having a difficult time, and sometimes they're having a horrific time, and therefore the whole system needs to be in place in order to help the child, including the school. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they should stay in school.
Are you surprised when you hear of a child who is thrown out of school and ultimately commits suicide? Does that like surprise you? Like, and what would you say to a principal who threw a kid out and the kid stopped suicide?
Oh my gosh, it is gut wrenching. I don't even know what I would say. It is absolutely gut wrenching. You know, the Welt is now talking about this series that the kids are probably watching. I'm not sure the parents are watching it, but the kids are certainly watching it, about someone who committed suicide, and it's like all over. Everyone's talking about it, and we shouldn't think that our kids, just because they don't have access to internet or smartphones or didn't see it, they'll go to someone else's house and watch it. And it's a gargantuan fail for everyone. Not just the school, and not just the friends, and not just the community, and it's everyone, and it is gut wrenching. I can't. Just to ask a child out of the building, let alone and let's say they succeed, and because they were asked out, they turned everything around, and it's still while you're going through it, it is absolutely horrific. And to have a child, to lose a child over it, I can't fathom what that feels like, for everyone. Including the principal, but to sit around and point fingers is not necessarily the solution. The solution is for everyone to get together and come up with what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and plans for how we're going to deal with things when they happen. You know, there are some communities that will have various kind of hangout places, for kids who are struggling. And in those hangout places, it's unconditional love. No one's going to tell you what to do or what not to do. You can come here, and this is a safe place for you. But you can't bring in things that are going to hurt other people. If you're struggling with something, then we'll help you with that. But you can't bring it here. What you can bring here is, you don't want the rules of the rest of the community to apply. Okay, in this particular space, you can be who you want to be. We're going to love you anyway. Okay, so that's a very difficult thing for a community to accept existing in their community. But maybe that's one of the solutions.
Rabbi, so let me change the topic. We had on a rabbi from Eretz Yisrael, who's an educator, and he said that in his experience, 80% of boys and 30% of girls have had, I'm not sure the exact verbiage, but a negative impact through pornography because of the internet and iPhones, the scourge of iPhones, right? And he believes it to be the Nisayan for educators of this generation. How do we educate? I mean, on one hand, if you don't give your child an iPhone, he considers that you're a caveman, or you're trying to. On the other hand, all you have to do is take an iPhone and mistype one word, and you get scrolling pornography that our grandparents never saw if they lived to 100 in a shtetl. How do we deal with the I personally agree with him. It's probably, it's certainly in the boys' schools, it's the biggest challenge.
It's a challenge everywhere. It is true that because of the psychological makeup of the girls, it's a little bit different, but it's ubiquitous anyway. In other words, it seeps in everywhere, especially the girls and the boys who are together and they're not staying separate. So then it seeps into their relationships, First of all, in our school, we have something we have our own program now called something that in the past we used was something called Project Safe, which basically is to teach, to educate. because the kids think that they know everything, but as kids in every generation, you know, they always think they know everything, and it turns out that there's a lot of things that they don't know. So number one, to educate. But number two, to educate the parents, because the parents are absolutely oblivious to what is going on their children's phones. Some of the most simple things, and that's assuming, of course, that they already have the phone. If the parent wasn't able to withstand that, obviously the best way is not to give them the smartphone and to completely monitor whatever. If they need some internet access to do some work, so to completely monitor that. But if you already gave your child the smartphone, and that's a whole other discussion. Then who's supervising that? How are you supervising it? Where is that smartphone, in the evening? Where is it charging? Is it charging is it with the child all night long? In which case, how can you possibly supervise it? Is it only to be used in a public space? Is it to be charged at night in the parents' bedroom so that after a certain hour the child doesn't have access to it anymore? Do you have the passwords to anywhere where your child can go? If you're going to give your child permission to use whatever is, are you able to see? Do you have monitoring software that can see every single thing that they've done? This has been true ever since personal computers, have existed, and it continues to be true. So if a parent, if you're not going to give them a smartphone in the first place, call Kavod. They need a cell phone perhaps because they travel. So good. So you have a cell phone, and you can actually program the cell phone so that it's only usable, at certain times and in certain places and on certain numbers. And, there's a lot of things you can do, but the parents have no idea because they grew up in a world that this stuff didn't exist, and it changes literally every year or two. So the parents have to be aware, and they're not. So that's the second step, is to educate the parents, or maybe the first step.
Well, Rabbi Yoritz, it's been a big honor having you on with us. You've been very helpful. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Kol tov, take care, bye-bye. You know, in summation, I'd like to say the following. If I offended any teachers, particularly, or mechanchim, I apologize. It's certainly not my goal. I think, again, like I said last time, the vast majority of them really mean it, l'shem shemayim, the girls, the boys. They live in poverty, many of them. We pay our teachers horribly, right? We pay our hedge fund managers a fortune, but the people who take care of our asid, our future, pre-bitnacha, all of our dreams, we pay terribly. So I certainly don't mean to. And additionally, I don't think that it's teachers. It's much more than the teachers. We saw from last week, yes, teachers, we heard from many of our guests, they need better education. One listener wrote me, and it's on our website. He said, they may learn in seminary. You learn halacha, you learn chumash. What do we know about child psychology? Same thing about Rabbeim. The best boy in Lakewood and Mir and Brisk and YU becomes Rabbi. What does he know about? Is he a psychologist? It took Myers-Briggs, before Myers and Briggs, which is in the last 50 years or so, maybe 75 years, people thought there were basically a few different types of personalities. Myers-Briggs said there's maybe 16 or 32 totally different personalities, which means we're very different. And it's funny, Klal Yisrael believes, Kishem Sheim Parzufeim Shavuos, we believe that there are no two personalities that really alike. And think of the challenge that creates for teachers, for parents. Additionally, we live in such a fast-changing society. It's astonishing. When I grew up, nobody had a cell phone. My kids first got their cell phones. My oldest got it post-high school. My second got it mid-high school. My third got it. My last one got it in eighth grade because she would have been the weirdo. How do we deal with all this? The Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara says you should not go. The Gemara, it's right before Re'u Bezdin. I forgot the daf, maybe Lamed Aleph on Bez, but it's right the Gemara right before Re'u Bezdin. The Gemara says you have to go only to the Shofet Asher Bayamim Ahem, because the Gemara knew a truth. Yesterday's Pesach, yesterday's Shofet, he cannot paskin today's Shilas, today's challenges. When I say the Shilas of Chinuch in particular, of our youth, of growing up, they're really, really changing. And it's incumbent for us as parents, as communities, to really be aware. aware, if we want to hold on to our children, do you remember when we were little, we looked at the greener, the guy from Europe, he didn't understand our children. It's worse today. We really have to understand our children. And you know where it goes back to? We believe Maisa Avei Simen Labanim. Avram was Midas HaChesed. Yitzchak, diametrically opposed, Midas HaDin. Yaakov is Rachmim. Each one was totally different. And you know, the Kotzke Rebbe, he was a brilliant psychologist. You know what he says? He says, it says by Yitzchak, Vayachbru Be'erim Acheres, they dug different wells. Because the wells of Avraham were stuffed up by the Pelishtim. And Kotzke uses it for a metaphor. He says, a well is a mayan. It's where life comes from. The water in the desert. That's, you know, the well, like it says, they used all the shepherds, it says in the beginning of Ayetze, or by Moshe, they used to put a rock on it to, so that all the shepherds together had to push it so that nobody could steal the water. It represented life itself, a well. He said, every generation has to dig its own wells. Each generation has its own inspiration. Yitzchak had to dig different wells than Avram. It's incumbent upon all of us as parents, as educators, as a community, to recognize we have to find the well of our community. The well is different, and we have to educate our children differently because of it. But remember, Ki'ish B'tzireh, we will figure it out. We are Klal Yisrael. We are the oldest nation, the oldest culture, and yet Ki'nar Yisrael V'yayaveyu, we are a child. We continue growing. We will figure this out. Have a wonderful week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.